Well, we're back, and we got a great class in store for you today, so don't miss out and leave early. We're going to talk about Paul, and he's probably the most important figure in Christianity next to Jesus. 14 of the 27 works in the New Testament have been attributed to him. He developed many of the most fundamental doctrines of Christianity. Okay. Now, at the time, it didn't look like it was going to end up that way, but it did end up that way. But there's a myth about Paul. Sometimes people say, well, you know, Paul was the founder of the mission to the Gentiles. He was the first one to go out and convert non-Jews. No, he wasn't. There were already missionaries before him that were taking Jesus' message to non-Jews, because we even have evidence in his letters of him going and visiting churches in Asia Minor and Greece that were already there. Okay, someone had started them. Okay, so he wasn't the first. However, he is the most important and the most popular and the most influential. All right, now, just like we did for Jesus, we have to get our sources for Paul together, right? I told you that there are 14 letters attributed to Paul. Okay, actually, only 13 actually say by Paul. All right, one of them, Hebrews. Everyone said, "Yeah, Paul wrote that," but never says he wrote it, and we don't think he did. But there are 13 letters that purport to be by Paul. All right, now the ones I have listed there under authentic Pauline letters, those seven, those are the ones that all scholars, well, 99% of them, say yes. Paul definitely wrote those. Then there are three, we call the Deutero-Pauline letters, that purport to be by Paul, but there is some difference of opinion on whether he did or not. So there's a division here. Some people say, yeah, I think Paul wrote those, and others say, no, I don't think he did. So they're questionable. And then there are the pseudo-Pauline letters, 1 and 2 Timothy and Titus. They're often called the pastoral letters that 95% of scholars believe Paul did not write, that they're from the early 2nd century, actually. All right, now, what this means is that if you are going to try to argue with someone, okay, here's what Paul believed or whatever, you're only going to convince them if you're going to use the 7 up authentic pile, okay? Anyway, how do scholars determine if Paul wrote it or not? How do you even know? Does anyone know how you tell? How do you tell? There is a little bit of science to this. It's not just like, let's just make this by Paul. You look at the vocabulary, the grammar, how what kind of language he uses. Okay, there's a certain vocabulary that's very much Paul. This is the words he likes to use, the way he likes to structure his sentences, things like that. As well as a style of writing, you know, certain style that Paul has. And also, they look at the message. Is the message consistent with Paul's message and his interests and so on and so forth? Okay? So those are some of the things that they look at to determine authenticity. So with these like Deutero-Pauline letters, there's some things that sound like Paul and there's some things that don't. So that's why they're kind of not sure about those. Okay? But the last three, we'll talk about them later, doesn't sound like Paul at all. Okay? Anyway, another source for Paul is the book of Acts, which you have read, or are supposed to have read, all right? Which is not written by Paul, written by the same author as the one who wrote the Gospel of Luke, but it's about this time period, and talks the second half of the book's all about Paul, okay? So it's a third-person narrative, but it tells us something about Paul, okay? Acts was probably written, I think I told you, somewhere in the 80s, something like that. It would be about 20 years after Paul died. But here's a weird thing. Acts talks about a lot of things that Paul does not talk about. They're saying he did this or he did that, and Paul never mentions it. And you went, well, you know, did he do that? Maybe Acts is right about it. But here's an interesting thing. When Paul's letters and Acts are compared, when you find something that both of them talk about, they all always disagree. I'll give you an example. Okay? In Acts chapter 9, Paul is converted to Christianity. And immediately after his conversion, he heads for Jerusalem and arrives there within a few days to confer with the apostles. In Galatians chapter 1, Paul states very emphatically that he made sure to stay away from Jerusalem after his conversion. In fact, he claims that he waited 3 years to make his very first trip there. And he says, and even when I did, I certainly did not consult with the apostles. I did see Peter. But he goes on to say about how he didn't need their approval for what he's doing. I don't need the apostles telling me I'm allowed to do this. Jesus talked to me personally. I'm doing it on his authority. And he's going on about this in Galatians, which you are reading, by the way. So what do you do with that, right? Now, you can understand why maybe the guy who wrote Acts wanted to make Paul buddy-buddy with the apostles as much as possible so that, you know, they went along. You know, Paul got his authority from them. But then there are, then you have Paul himself is saying, I did it how I wanted. They didn't make me an apostle. I'm not an apostle because a man told me I am. I'm an apostle because Jesus told me. By the way, this helps us to understand Paul. You know, his big problem is, how can he call himself an apostle if he never met Jesus? So he says that Jesus appeared to him in spirit after Jesus died, on the road, and told him, I want you to be an apostle, and that's how he gets his authority. Okay? All right, but despite the problematic nature of Acts and Paul's letters, you know, we do favor Paul's letters over Acts when we're trying to reconstruct Paul's life, but in cases where we don't have anything in Paul's letters about something, we tend to say, okay, well, maybe Acts knows something, and we give it some credence, but, you know, we don't know for certain. Okay? Okay, so some probable facts about Paul. We can sketch a rough biography of his life. One thing we didn't have with Jesus is Jesus' own writings. We do have that with Paul, so that helps. Okay. Paul was probably born in the first decade of the first century sometime in the city of Tarsus, which is in Asia Minor, right where Asia Minor kind of hits the eastern seaboard of the Mediterranean, right in the armpit there. That's right around where Tarsus is. And there was a significant, Jewish population there. But it was a Greek-speaking city. It was a Hellenistic city. It wasn't a Jewish city, but there were Jews there. Okay, Paul's native language, we know, was Greek. All his letters are in Greek, and he knows it very well. And also in Tarsus, the main language there is Greek. That his given name was actually Saul, not Paul, but that when he converted to Christianity, he changed it to Paul. We know that he was raised as a Pharisee. He was Jewish, raised as a Pharisee. He was very well educated by his parents. Acts says that as a young man, Paul, you know, traveled to Jerusalem and studied under a very famous Pharisee. Now, we don't know if that's true, but we have no reason to really doubt it. So Paul says himself that he was considered very righteous among fellow Jews. So he was really into it. He's very into Judaism. And in fact, we also know that just before his conversion, he was in league with the Sadducees, even though he himself was a Pharisee. He was in league with the Sadducees to try to stamp out the Jesus movement in Jerusalem. And he was responsible for the death of many followers of Jesus. But then he says, Jesus met him on the road, and told him, hey, cut it out, and I want you to be an apostle. And then he decided to convert. Then he went on all these missionary tours. Okay? And I think I have, they are here, some of his missionary tours. Some of the places he traveled, okay, to spread the gospel. And then around the year 60-something or other, we're not exactly sure the exact year, he was arrested in Jerusalem, but sent to Rome for trial because he was apparently a Roman citizen. And we don't know what the exact charges were, but he probably was executed around the year 64. All right, now the letter to the Galatians, which I signed to you to read. Paul never wrote a systematic treatise or book on his theology. You know, all we have are his letters. And they do provide us quite a bit of information about Paul, but he doesn't talk about everything. Okay, and we have to be careful when we're using his letters to reconstruct his beliefs because these letters are written for specific occasions. Like there were issues that were going on at a particular church, and he wants to talk about those issues. Okay, they don't appear to have been intended to be written to a general audience because they are specifically about the problems that that particular church was experiencing. He's not like addressing everybody. He's addressing specific things. Okay, so we're looking at his mail. But he does talk about a number of his beliefs. He doesn't say a lot about his beliefs concerning the nature of Christ. We don't really know, like, exactly what his Christology was. Like, did he think Jesus was God or a man or something in between? Or did he have a pre-human existence or not? You know, we don't know any of that with Paul. But we do know a number of his teachings, and that's what I want to tell you about. Anyway, the letter to the Galatians, he writes to Christian churches that were in the region of Galatia, which is a Roman province in Asia Minor. And it's principally concerned with controversy that I was just telling you about. What do Gentiles have to do to become followers of Jesus? What kind of conversion requirements are there? Okay, and as you know, he's very much against having to be Jewish, having to follow the Torah, which is funny because he himself was a Pharisee. He was really into Judaism, but he's letting all that go. Okay, and what's interesting is that he does mention that and so does Acts, that he himself founded the churches in Galatia. Then he left, and after he left, those churches were visited by Judaizer preachers who were telling them that they needed to follow the Torah. And this letter is Paul's angry response. He heard about people going there, Judaizers, maybe sent from James or something like that, and he is pissed. All right, so he's. It's always interesting to read one of his letters when he's mad, and you can kind of tell that when you're reading it. So he's talking about this issue, and you learn a lot about his theology from that. So the tone of Galatians is very defensive. It would appear from what we can tell in Paul's letter that the Judaizers cited the example of Abraham where, hey, Abraham was circumcised, and that was even before the Torah came about. So they should at least get circumcised. But he has a response to that in the letter. If we add to Galatians some of the other bits of info we get from his other letters, we can get a few of his views on important issues here, especially with this controversy. Paul believed that obeying the commandments given in the Torah could not help a person attain salvation. In fact, Paul believed that observing the commandments of the Torah might even hurt a person's chances. He said that the Torah sets such a high standard for everyone that no one could be found righteous according to the standards of the Torah. Oh, by the way, I probably should mention this. In Greek, when you translate the Torah into Greek, they use the word nomos, which means law. Okay? So you'll just see it usually translated in English as law. So sometimes we'll be talking about the law. What law is he talking about? He's talking about the Torah. Okay? The Jewish law. Sometimes he refers to law in general. So if he doesn't have the there, he might just be referring to law in general. But if he's talking about the law, that's the Jewish Torah, just so you know. Okay. Anyway, he says that religious Jews who attempt to follow the Torah are actually no better in God's eyes than Gentiles who don't follow it at all. Why? Because neither of them are really doing it. The Jews who try to follow it can't really live up to it, so they're failing. The Gentiles who don't do it at all are failing too, so what's the difference? Okay. He says that having to live under regulations, okay, if that determines following regulations, if that determines whether you're going to make it or not, he says, everyone's dead. So, let's just forget about it then. Justification by faith. This is Paul's answer to the whole question of, you know, what makes a Gentile convert acceptable to God? All right, able to be in the church. All right, how is he or she justified? Justification, all right, is being right with God. God says, we're good, we're straight. Okay, now how do you get justified before God? By following the Torah or any other laws? No. By faith, he says. Okay? Here's a little excerpt from Galatians. We know, this is from Galatians 2:16, we know that no one is justified by the works of the law, but by faith in Jesus Christ. And we have believed in Christ Jesus so that we might be justified by faith in Christ and not by the works of the law, because by the works of the law, no human being will be justified. So he's very clear about that. Faith is what gets you justified, and that's good enough reason for you to be in our group. Now, what is it that allows God to justify you just for that, nothing else? Paul uses the word grace. Grace, I don't mean like being graceful, all right? Grace is kindness or favor shown to someone who doesn't deserve it. So Paul is admitting, we are horrible sinners, he says. We don't deserve to be justified, all right? But God's being nice to us because we have faith. And he's like, well, at least you got faith. Okay, we're all right. Okay. That's basically what he's saying here. All right? So you're justified by faith. Now, he's not really clear about what is involved in faith. Okay? Does he mean faith in who Jesus is, what Jesus did or does, what Jesus taught? What does it mean to have faith in Jesus? He doesn't say. All right? And that's for later theologians to wrangle about. The third point. Paul is the first that we know of. Of course, he's our earliest source, so he would be the first. But anyway, he is the first that we know of who centers more attention on this one great event here than he does on any of Jesus' teachings. Paul does not really talk about Jesus' teachings hardly at all. But he does talk a lot about how Jesus died and was resurrected. Talks about that all the time because he makes it a central point, a focal point of the faith. Now, why? Well, he makes it into something more than just a great martyrdom. I mean, originally probably that's what it was. You know, oh wow, Jesus died for a great cause, you know, whatever. But Paul says, no, it's a lot more than that. It means something. Now, other people past Paul, later on, will make Jesus' death and resurrection even more significant, giving it other meanings, okay? But I'm going to tell you the meaning that he gives it. He says that every time someone puts faith in Jesus and joins up, okay, joins with the church, they die and are resurrected just like Jesus was. They die and they come back to life. Now, that doesn't mean like for real, okay? He means their old self dies and they are reborn as a new person. All right? And by doing this, they're imitating Jesus. The baptism kind of goes along with this too, because it's like when you go underwater, you are being buried in the grave, and then you come back out and you're alive again. Okay, but the idea is you're a new person, the old self dies, a new person comes back. But when you do it, he gives it kind of a mystical meaning as well. It's almost like when you imitate Jesus like that, you somehow become spiritually connected with him. You're now one with Jesus and in some special mystical way, all right? So he's the first to really give this kind of special higher significance to the death of Jesus. So I want to mention that too. Other people later on will add other further elements to this death and resurrection thing, but he's the one that starts the ball rolling. Okay? All right. Now, James. As you can imagine, Paul's message, his Hellenizer message, didn't really sit well with many of Jesus' more conservative Jewish followers. All right? And Paul's principal opponent during this period seems to have been Jesus' brother James. Galatians, that you're reading, that you read, and the book of Acts, which you also read, make it seem as if James is kind of like the guy in charge. He is at least the guy in charge in Jerusalem. Paul in Galatians, you know, speaks of James as he's like the leader over there in the Jerusalem church. Luke even, I mean, in Acts, I call the author of Acts Luke because he wrote Luke too. But anyway, in Acts, you see James also taking a very prominent role. And he apparently had such a great reputation that they gave him the nickname James the Just, or James the Righteous. Same word. James the Just. So if you ever hear of James the Just, it's talking about this guy. All right. But both Acts and Paul's letters suggest that Paul and James disagreed on this issue. Okay? That's why, for example, when you look at chapter 2 of Galatians, he says, when Cephas, that's Peter, came to Antioch, I opposed him to his face because he stood condemned. For he used to eat with the Gentiles before certain men came from James. However, when they came, he withdrew and separated himself because he feared those from the circumcision party. Then the rest of the Jews joined his hypocrisy so that even Barnabas was carried away by their hypocrisy. But when I saw that they were deviating from the truth of the gospel, I told Cephas in front of everyone, if you who are a Jew live like a Gentile and not like a Jew, how can you compel Gentiles to live like Jews? However, we can see a little bit about what James thinks in the letter of James, which I believe I also had you read. Okay, we're not entirely positive it was written by James because it's written in very, very good Greek, and we don't have any evidence that James was that fluent in Greek, or even if he was literate at all. But one thing's for certain, it definitely has the opinion of James. Okay, it definitely presented from James' point of view, whatever the case. And it says in that letter that people don't just need faith, okay? They need to have works, and in particular, the works of the law. So here's what James says. This is in chapter 2. He says, what good is it? This is in verse 14. What good is it, my brothers, if someone says he has faith but does not have works? Can his faith save him? And then he gives the example like, he says, if a brother or sister is without clothes and lacks daily food, and one of you says to them, go in peace, keep warm and eat well, but you don't give them what the body needs, what good is it? In the same way, faith, if it doesn't have works, is dead by itself. Okay? But someone will say, you have faith and I have works. Show me your faith without works, and I'll show you faith from my works. You believe that God is one? You do well. The demons also believe, and they shudder. He's saying, faith? The demons believe in God. Are they going to be saved? Obviously not. Okay? So clearly, belief is not enough. All right, and he says earlier, specifically, like in verse 8, if you really carry out the royal law prescribed in Scripture, and then he gives examples, love your neighbor as yourself, you're doing well. Then he talks about do not commit adultery, do not murder, other parts of the law. He calls it the law of freedom as well. The royal law, the law of freedom. Those are typical Jewish expressions, by the way, of the time for the Torah. But he even more blatant, he says a little bit later here, verse 24. You see that a man is justified by works and not by faith alone. Now compare that with what we just read with in Paul, Galatians. We know that no one is justified by the works of the law, but by faith in Jesus Christ. And we have believed in Christ Jesus so that we might be justified by faith in Christ and not by the works of the law, because by the works of the law no human being will be justified. And then you have James saying, a man is justified by works and not by faith alone. By the way, the passage here in Galatians from Paul doesn't have it in this particular English translation, but in the actual Greek, the message is faith by itself, faith alone. All right. If works are required, then the whole Hellenizer position falls apart because then the Gentiles have to do something. They have to follow rules and regulations in order to become part of the church, and Paul does not want that. Okay? James does. So I'm sure James and Paul had some interesting conversation. Now, this leads into a very important historical event here called the Council of Jerusalem. The Council of Jerusalem, sometimes it's called the Apostolic Conference because apostles were there, is a name applied to a meeting described in the book of Acts chapter 15 and also probably in Paul's his letter to the Galatians in the second chapter. Okay? He talks about after 14 years he went to Jerusalem. That's probably the same occasion as is being described in Acts chapter 15. And those events are generally dated to around the year 50. But the purpose of the meeting, according to the book of Acts anyway, was to resolve the disagreement about this whole issue. All right? And in particular about circumcision. Do the Gentiles need to get circumcised? It says in Acts 15 that men were saying, these Judaizer men were saying, not only that they had to get circumcised, but also that they had to follow the law of Moses. So everybody who was anybody was there. James was there. Peter was there. Paul was there. And Paul brought a bunch of his Gentile friends, his uncircumcised Gentile friends with him. Okay? And came into the meeting. And he had them talking about all these great things that were happening in Asia Minor and Greece and all that. To show them that things were good the way they were. And so they were arguing about it. All right? And according to the book of Acts, Peter suggested a compromise, kind of a middle ground. He says, how about this? We give them just a few important laws from the Torah to follow. All right, just a handful, but not the whole thing. And they don't have to get circumcised. So you don't have to get circumcised, okay? And we'll just have you follow these just few handful of laws. Now, the interesting that the laws that he chose were not just picked randomly, okay? They were actually used by Jews before, okay? For those who wanted to, like, join up with another Jewish sect but didn't want to go all the way, there were some rules and regulations they had to follow that were part of the Torah, but they didn't have to do the whole thing. Well, these were taken from that list. Okay? But what's interesting is that a number of them are dietary regulations. Okay? And here's what it says. And James actually signed on to this, according to Acts anyway. And he wrote it down as if it was from him. He says, my decision is that we trouble no further those who from among the Gentiles are turned to God, but that we write to them that they, number one, abstain from pollutions of idols, meaning you don't eat meat that has been sacrificed to an idol. Okay? That's one of their laws. And from sexual sins. Okay? And from things strangled, because you're not allowed to eat strangled animals. And from blood, from eating blood. So a number of dietary regulations here. Actually, they all are dietary regulations except for the sexual sins. And that's often called the apostolic decree. Now, they did send a letter out to a number of churches saying, that's all we want. That's all we want from you. Okay? But we have evidence in Paul's letters that there were Judaizers who did not listen to this and continued to say you had to get circumcised and continued to say you had to follow the whole Torah. And Paul himself seemed to still be pushing the envelope the other way. In one of his letters, he says, you know, about this eating food sacrificed to idols, it's all right. You can go ahead and do it. Just don't tell anybody that if it's going to offend them, all right? But there's really nothing wrong with it. Okay. So he stuck to his guns. Anyway, that was the result of the Council of Jerusalem. And by the way, there would not be another big council like this for another 200 years. Okay. No other big meetings. And probably the reason for that is after the fall of Jerusalem, which we're going to talk about next, there was no really central area that, you know, they could actually decide to tell other people what to do. So we don't see another council for a long time. Anyway, the Judaizers continued to push the Torah on their churches, and the Hellenizers continued to reject the Torah in their churches. So it really doesn't get resolved. We have evidence of very Jewish-minded churches existing among Christians for several more centuries. Okay, so this is just to kind of lay out the different factions, all right, three main ones. These are later pictures of the the guys we're talking about. But James' party, sometimes called the circumcision party, they still believed in the Jewish ways, very pro-temple, pro-Torah, circumcision you should do. On the other side, you got Paul, right, the Hellenizers. They're anti-temple, anti-Torah, no circumcision. And then you have Peter's compromisers in the middle, okay? Just some basic laws, but not everything. Now, you would think that the middle position would be the one that would win out in the end because it's a compromise. But it isn't. Paul's position wins out. When I say wins out, I mean becomes the majority opinion. These other positions don't disappear, okay? But Paul's becomes the main majority, I guess you could say, opinion eventually. Okay, and we're going to discuss how that happens and why as we go on here, but just letting you know. Now, the apostolic period kind of ends with a bang. We're going to talk about the first Jewish revolt. It kind of changes a lot of things, but first of all, to lead up to it, just a few words about some of the hostilities between the Romans and the Jews during this apostolic period. First of all, Caligula. You've heard of Caligula? Doesn't sound like a vampire's name. Anyway, Caligula was a Roman emperor, and he was also a megalomaniac. He ordered a statue of himself to be erected in the temple at Jerusalem. Put a statue of himself for people to worship. Part of the imperial cult, okay? But you don't just, you know, go into the Jewish temple and erect a statue. That's, they tried to do that before and didn't go over very well. It never happened, though, because he ended up getting assassinated in 41 before the plan could be carried out. But when the order went through, there were all kinds of popular protests about it. And this is kind of fueling the fire for the Jews to have resentment towards the Roman government. Then, a little bit later, in the reign of Claudius, right after that, there was a controversy in the city of Rome. There was a Jewish community there living in Rome, the city. And the controversy is mentioned in kind of an offhand manner by the Roman historian Suetonius. And he says this, just one little sentence here. He says, the Jews constantly made disturbances at the instigation of Crestus, and he expelled them from Rome. Meaning Claudius expelled the Jews from Rome. But what a lot of people wonder about is, like, who's this Crestus that instigated this Jewish disturbance? Some people have said, well, Crestus is almost like Christus. So is that Christ? And then maybe it's talking about Christians here, not Jews. But we don't think that. I mean, he's got things mixed up and he doesn't know the difference between Jews and the followers of Jesus or anything like that. But whatever the case, it was definitely a Jewish thing. There doesn't seem to be any evidence that any followers of Jesus were involved. Eusebius claims in his history that all the Jews were expelled from Rome, but that's unlikely. There were probably some Jews that were expelled from Rome at the time, but it doesn't seem like all of them were. Anyway, this is just another one of those disturbances that's causing more resentment between the two parties. We also have, during this period, a growth of Jewish militant groups. I already told you a little bit about the militant groups, right, when we were doing the Jews before. But it was during the 50s, in particular, that these groups increased in number and they became more active. Some of them, believing that God would be their helper, thought in terms of forcing God to protect his own name by intervening on their behalf. In other words, they're kind of making him act. Let's say you got your group of Jews, right, and you go out and you're outnumbered and you go attack the Romans or whatever, and then they start slaughtering you. You're thinking to yourself, well, maybe God will see his people here getting hurt and then he will do something about it, right? So even though, yeah, we know we're outnumbered, okay, but doesn't matter when you got God on your side, he'll help, okay? But not all Jews were like this, of course, just a small minority. Josephus, the Jewish historian, talks about the entire land being overrun by bandits during the 50s. Very dangerous to travel around. Okay, he actually makes a distinction between these highwaymen, bandits, and a common criminal. He doesn't act like they're just muggers. Okay, the bandits are some kind of revolutionary. So people are mugging people, all right, but they're doing it for a cause or something like that. It's not just simply trying to make some money or just a regular robber. They are some kind of revolutionary group that are resorting to banditry to kind of get their movement going and get money for it and things like that. All right. There was another group he called, and you don't have to remember this, but they're called the Sicarii, which means the dagger men. And he says that they were like, their group tended to try to assassinate political opponents. And their usual method was to slip into a crowd on a busy day at the marketplace and approach some, you know, important political official that they didn't like, a Jewish official, but one that favored the Romans or something like that, and pull out a dagger, kill him. But there were so many people around, right? You just put the dagger back in your tunic and you act all surprised like everyone else. Oh, what happened? You know, and no one knows who did it. Okay? So they get rid of people like that. And they also resorted to kidnappings and extortion and robbery and things like that. Okay? But he says, Josephus says that they did it in broad daylight and they got away with it. So things are coming to a head here. Finally, in the year 66, that's when the revolt actually comes about. And Josephus says it was started by a group called the Zealots. And see, so there's all kinds of different militant groups, but the Zealots, he says, are the ones who started the war. What happened was there was this fighting between the Romans and the Jews, the militant groups. The militant groups would, like, do something. Like, they'd destroy some Roman installation or whatever. And then the Roman governor would send in troops and he'd slaughter a bunch of innocent people in retaliation. And then everyone got even more upset, and then they would attack back, and then it's just spiraled out of control until you have all-out war. All right? Anyway, so that happened in 66 where hostilities broke out, and the Roman procurator, the governor, he was very anti-Jewish, so he wasn't helping the situation because of his policies. I mean, on one occasion, he actually went into the temple treasury in Jerusalem and took a bunch of gold and said, this is for the emperor, and left with it. He didn't have any like special orders with papers or anything. He just went in, had his guys take the gold, and he said, oh, we need this, and left. And that made everyone very, very mad, as you might guess. Well, the militants were able to throw the Romans out of Jerusalem and take over the city. And they set up their own independent provisional government. And they stopped making sacrifices on behalf of the emperor, of course. They were doing that before that. And that was basically a declaration of war from the Roman point of view. So the Romans decide they have to respond. The emperor at the time was Emperor Nero. You probably heard of him. And he sends in his best general, Vespasian, that's the guy up on the top there, to go in and kick some butt. All right. Now, by this time, city after city in Judea is revolting, and then cities in the Galilee start revolting as well up in the north. So Vespasian comes in 67, and he starts in Galilee, and he's going to work his way south. And it's not too difficult for him. One by one, he captures city after city, and he, you know, is defeating the various Jewish rebels up there. But before he gets down into near Jerusalem, there are problems at home. Nero commits suicide, and he has no heirs. So there is no clear person to take the throne as emperor of Rome. So various generals start fighting over who gets to be emperor. And Vespasian himself wants to be emperor. So he leaves and he goes back to Rome, and after the smoke clears, he does secure the throne for himself and becomes the next Roman emperor. Okay? Now, during the time that he's gone, the Jews are doing great without him. Well, they're not doing that great, but what happens is the provisional government that they had set up had been rather moderate. But during the period after the Romans leave, the more radical elements of the society kind of take over the government, and these very, you know, I guess you could call them leftist militants are now in charge of Jerusalem, okay? And they start going after all their Jewish political enemies during this period, and there's a lot of bloodshed. It's like purging, reign of terror, you might say, in Jerusalem itself. And a lot of people get killed. Well, Vespasian, now that he's the emperor, he's willing to start the war back up, but he's not going to go himself. So he sends his son, Titus, that's this guy, to go finish up. Titus is the one who eventually lays siege to the city of Jerusalem. And after several months, the city finally falls. And Titus enters the city, and he lets his troops pretty much do whatever they want, and they just destroy everything, and they actually completely burn down the temple and, you know, raise it to the ground as a lesson, okay, to the Jews. That happened in the year 70. And so the Jews were subjugated and lost. All right. By the way, during the siege, the famine was horrible. There were all kinds of atrocities that were occurring. It was a really bad time for the Jews inside the city while the siege was going on, fighting in the streets and just carnage galore, all kinds of thievery and murder. But anyway, it ended in 70 when the Romans took over. You can see right here on the bottom right, this is one of the panels on the Arch of Titus, which is in the city of Rome, commemorating the victory. And you can see them in a parade, parading all the treasures that they took from the temple. You can see a menorah there they're holding, and all this gold and stuff that they took from the Jewish temple. It was a big thing for the Romans. This was like one of their big wars, and they were very proud to have won it. After Titus left, there was another legion stationed there to kind of finish mopping up. And one of the groups, the Sicarii, were holed up in the fortress of Masada. It's a fortress that Herod the Great had built, impregnable practically, on a plateau very high up. You couldn't get into it. It took a couple of years for the Romans to finally get into the fortress. They had to build a ramp up to get up there. And when the Roman general finally entered the fortress in 73, according to the legend anyway, he went in, and everyone was already dead. They were laying there all dead. They had committed suicide rather than be taken by the Romans. And that, 73, was the official end of the conflict. Okay. Apocalypses associated with the war. We learned about apocalypses before, remember? Prediction, you know, these symbolic books predicting the end of the world and everything that was going to happen and so on and so forth. And a lot of Jews and, well, not a lot of Jews, but a number of Jews and a number of Christians thought that this could be it, right? And apocalypses were written during this period that kind of reflect this belief. It can be seen in the Gospels themselves. What is often called the little apocalypse of Jesus is in the Synoptic Gospels, Mark, Luke, and Matthew. And so you read the Luke version, all right, where it starts out, there's a conversation between Jesus and his disciples. This is in Luke 21, verse 5. As some were talking about the temple complex, how it was adorned with beautiful stones and gifts dedicated to God, he, Jesus, said, "These things that you see, the days will come when not one stone will be left on another that will not be thrown down." He's predicting the fall of Jerusalem, right? "Teacher," they asked him, "when will these things be, and what will be the sign when these things are about to take place?" And then he starts telling you things that will happen, okay, as signs that the destruction is coming. I'm not going to read the whole thing. But then when you get to verse 20, he says, "When you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then recognize that its desolation has come near. Then those in Judea must flee to the mountains. Those inside the city must leave it, and those who are in the country must not enter it, because these are days of vengeance to fulfill all the things that are written." Okay? And he says in 24, they will fall by the edge of the sword and be led captive into all the nations. And Jerusalem will be trampled by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. Now, what is interesting about this is he continues. All right? And what happens next can only be described as the end of the world. Then there will be signs in the sun and moon and stars, and there will be anguish on the earth among nations, bewildered by the roaring sea and waves. People will faint from fear and expectation of the things that are coming on the world, because the celestial powers will be shaken. And then they will see the Son of Man coming in the cloud with power and great glory. But when these things begin to take place, stand up and lift up your heads, because your redemption is near. And then he said something very interesting. He says, he told them a parable. Look at the fig tree and all the trees. As soon as they put out leaves, you can see for yourselves and recognize that summer is already near. In the same way, when you see these things happen, recognize that the kingdom of God is near. So he's saying, when you see this happening in Jerusalem, the kingdom of God is near. I assure you, he says, this generation will certainly not pass away until all things take place. It's going to happen in your lifetime. It's kind of similar to the Essene view. They also believe that this was going to lead into the end. All right. Now, Mark 13 and Matthew 24 are also the same account, slightly different wording, but remember, these guys are all copying from each other, but this is the little apocalypse of Jesus. Now, what a lot of people don't realize is that the book of Revelation is an expanded version of the little apocalypse. It takes Jesus' little apocalypse in the Gospels and makes it into a full-blown book. Okay? But it is about the same thing. Now, yes, because it is so symbolic and there's all these signs and all that, they can be interpreted in a million different ways. But if you understand the historical context, the time that it was written, and what it's about, it makes sense. One thing that people always kind of skip over is the very beginning of the book. I didn't have you read this, but where it says, the revelation of Jesus Christ that God gave him to show his slaves what must soon take place. Soon. Okay? At the end, it says the same thing. Jesus says, I am coming soon. So when was the book published? In the first century. Okay? Now, there's a disagreement about the date of the book. Some people think it was as late as 95 that it was written, but others say it was written during the Jewish War, which makes more sense for a few different reasons. The only reason they date it late is because there's a later Christian tradition, and I think Eusebius recounts it, that it occurred during the reign of the Emperor Domitian, who lived in the 90s. However, there are other reasons for the earlier date, one of which is that according to the book, the temple appears to still be standing. Also, in the beginning, there are letters to different churches, and one of them, the one at Pergamum, it says that there is where the throne of Satan is. And Pergamum was the center of the imperial cult in Asia Minor in the first century, but by the time you get to the reign of Domitian in the 90s, it had transferred to Ephesus. So when the book was written, it was still at Pergamum. The apocalypses, if you recall, are usually written in a critical situation where there people are going through a terrible time and they need to be comforted. Okay? Fits very well into that period. And the problem of emperor worship is very big in the book. Okay? Talks about the an image being made of the Roman Empire and everyone has to bow down to it, and if they don't, they're going to get killed and so on and so forth. And this is the problem that the Gentile Christians were having. You see, well, I'll talk more about this later, but Gentile Christians did not have any exemption from the imperial cult. Jewish Christians could say, I'm Jewish, and we don't have to engage in the imperial cult. Okay? They have an exemption. Gentile Christians could not do that, and they were often persecuted by the Romans for not engaging in the imperial cult. I'm not really going to go on and on about the book of Revelation since you didn't read it. It could be a whole subject of a whole class. Anyway, it fits well with the historical context. We can never take a book out of its historical context or we lose a lot because we won't understand it. As soon as you take it and put it somewhere else, And that book is one example of a book that's every century people say, oh, it's about us. But they're pulling it out of its historical context. All right. Anyway, the aftermath. Any consideration of the effects of the fall of Jerusalem on Christianity has to take into account a number of basic facts. First of all, the impact upon those Christians who were native Jews is going to be different from the impact upon Christians who were from Gentile backgrounds. Second, there were distinct groups or parties within the church before the year 70, and most notably in the Church of Jerusalem. Some Jewish Christians were more closely tied to the national institutions of Judaism than were others. Okay? So they believe in Jesus, but they still have a thing for the Jewish institutions, and they may have been more supportive of this revolt than other Jewish Christians who may have said, oh, no, I don't think we should have anything to do with this. So there probably was a difference of opinion. But it would be hard to overstate the magnitude of the trauma of this war on the Jews. The Romans themselves thought it was a great thing. Vespasian himself put on coins. See that coin up there? That's a coin put out during the reign of Vespasian. And it says, Judea capta. Judea captured. He's bragging about it. On his coin. It's like a big thing for him. The event sent quite a number of shockwaves to the Jewish population, both at home and also in the diaspora, which would be the Jews elsewhere in the empire. Josephus reports that a total of 1.1 million casualties was a result of this war, mostly Jewish. And another 97,000 Jews were taken prisoner. So the loss of life was devastating. But that's not the big thing. I mean, that's bad. But for them, the temple, the destruction of the temple, the symbol of Jewish nationalism is now gone. There were other discernible effects. The province of Judea was reorganized and renamed Palestine. Okay, as kind of an affront to the Jews. We're not going to name it after you anymore. We're going to call it Palestina in Latin. We're going to name it after those Philistines that used to live there a long time ago. Maybe even worse, a new war tax was imposed upon the Jews called the Fiscus Judaeus. They had to pay for the war. All right? And it's kind of ironic because, you know, the whole taxation thing was kind of one of those things that made them mad at the Romans, and now they're even more heavily taxed than they were before. And they had to face the constant pressure of a Roman presence in the area to keep the peace. And what happens is the Jewish population gradually begins to move northward, a lot of them anyway, into the region of Galilee. That didn't that was part of the war, but it didn't experience as much destruction as Judea. And over time, Galilee, that area, will become the new center of Judaism. Only could have happened as a result of this war. The new Judaism would be based on the beliefs of the Pharisees. Because the Sadducees don't have their temple anymore. They were the priests. The Essenes, none of their expectations came true, so they die out. But the Pharisees, they do well. And they begin to develop their oral law into written form, and it will eventually turn into what we call the Talmud. But that'll be later. Now, what's the Christian effects here? We have to distinguish between Jewish and Gentile Christians, but the military defeat that ended in the destruction of the temple affected the young Jewish church in a few different ways. The fact that the war against Rome took place without Christian participation, mainly, widened the breach between the Jews and the followers of Jesus. So there's going to be a growing gap, a separation between Jews and Christians as a result of this. It's going to detach them from one another even more. Okay? It also detaches the church from Jerusalem. Now, before this, Jerusalem was kind of a place you look, oh, that's where the apostles go, you know? That's kind of where it all started. It's kind of an important city, right? No more. The church in Jerusalem was gone. It will be refounded later, but that's no longer an important center for the religion anymore, for the Christian religion. All right? Also, it provides the Christian church with a very powerful propaganda weapon against the Jews. Okay? They claimed that the fall of Jerusalem was evidence that God had removed his favor from the Jews and is now putting it on the Christians. See, as long as you had a temple there and the Jews were doing their thing, the Jews could say, well, see, God's with us, not with you. But now the Christians can say, hey, God rejected you. Now he's with us. Okay? In the book of Revelation, in fact, there's that very idea when it says, it calls Jerusalem a filthy, disgusting whore, and that's the opinion of the writer, okay? And talks about the new Jerusalem coming down as a beautiful bride from heaven and marrying Jesus, okay? A replacement, okay? So this is the new propaganda from the point of view of the church. This is gradually going to increase, by the way, Christian prejudice against the Jews and even hatred for the Jews, and we're going to see a lot more anti-Semitic literature being produced by Christians after this event. Another important effect is that it tips the scales in favor of the Hellenizer faction in the church. The ones that say, oh, we don't have to follow the Jewish Torah. Right? Now they can see, I told you that Jewish Torah stuff was no good. All right, look what happened to them. And so this enabled the Hellenizers to continue to push their point of view, and that's why they become the mainstream view. Okay? Doesn't mean that the Jewish Christians disappear, but the Gentile Christians and their Hellenizer point of view becomes more prevalent. The persistence of apocalyptic thinking. The failure of the revolt would gradually result in a shift in apocalyptic thinking for both Jews and Christians, but not overnight. There were apocalyptic sentiments that stayed on. People still were believing that something might happen. There was, in 20 years after this, a new batch of Jewish apocalypses appeared, and there would be a second revolt, and that ended the same way. Okay, but there was a comeback in that. As far as the Christian point of view is regarding the apocalypses, the Christians tended to move away from that idea. Not all. There will be different Christian groups that continue to produce apocalypses and think the end of the world is going to come any day, all right? But they will become more and more a minority. And after the second Jewish revolt, the Jews too will kind of put away these apocalyptic ideas, and that will fall by the wayside, okay? But I just want to say that there were segments of both Jews and Christians that will continue to persist in this apocalyptic way of thinking. And in the second century, there are a number of Christian apocalypses that are written. Okay, none of them come true, but they still think that the end is right around the corner, some of these groups. Okay, Eusebius, if you read him, he's very anti-apocalyptic. Okay, he doesn't believe in that stuff, and so he criticizes anyone who does. All right, but he clearly knows of Christians who believe that stuff. The book of Revelation itself will be reinterpreted even by Christians in the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th centuries as maybe still going to be fulfilled. And finally, we got the Pella legend, which is kind of interesting. There's a legend that developed that after the death of James, the brother of Jesus, said he was stoned to death by the Sadducees in the year 62. That's what Josephus tells us. Probably there's some truth to that. Josephus is not a Christian, has no stake in it one way or the other. But after the death of James, it is said that the church in Jerusalem left the city. This is before the revolt. That the church in Jerusalem left the city, because the revolt started in 66, and migrated to a place called Pella, which is a city in the Decapolis. I showed you where the Decapolis was on the first day. Now here's what Eusebius says. He says, the people of the church at Jerusalem, in accordance with a certain oracle that was vouchsafed by way of revelation to approved men there, had been commanded to depart from the city before the war and to inhabit a certain city of Perea. They called it Pella. And after those who believed in Christ had left Jerusalem, as if holy men had utterly deserted both the royal metropolis of the Jews and the whole land of Judea, the justice of God then visited upon them all their acts, the Jews' acts of violence toward Christ and his apostles, by destroying that generation of wicked persons, root and branch. You can tell what Eusebius thinks of the Jews. Anyway, so he says that, though, that the church in Jerusalem left the city before the war broke out and went to Pella. We see it mentioned in some of the later writers after Eusebius too. So, did this happen? That's the question. Is there truth in this story? Well, here's a few things we have to keep in mind. First of all, the legend kind of serves to show a high degree of separation between Christians and Jews even before the war. Okay? And it makes it look like the Christians had nothing to do with the revolt, and they weren't even around, and they rejected the Jews even before God rejected them. But is that realistic? Does it fit the historical context? We wonder about that. The story supports later church ideology, and we know we have to be suspicious of that. Okay? There is no documentary evidence to confirm that the church in Jerusalem fled the war. There is nothing. The Christian Justin Martyr, he comes up in the second century. He says, and he's speaking about the second Jewish revolt that took place in the 130s, he says that there were Christians in the city during the second revolt. Now, either you have to say, well, they must have gone back, okay, or maybe they were in the area the whole time and they never left, okay, and that they suffered some of the consequences of the war. We don't really know. On the other hand, we do have evidence in the Gospels where Jesus told his followers to get out of the city. That might suggest that people did leave the city. But it's hard to tell. Okay? The book of Revelation, likening the Jerusalem church to a woman, says that she fled into the wilderness. And some people think that maybe that means that they did actually, the church of Jerusalem fled the city. So it's possible. Okay. All we can say at this point is maybe, maybe not. But the legend about going to Pella, that's later. And we, even if they left the city, we have no idea where they would have gone. Maybe it was Pella, but it's a later legend, so it's hard to say. All right, we're out of time. We have all kinds of other interesting things to talk about next time, so stay tuned.